Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Clatsop County Historical Tonight.
It feels
historical
weird.
Historical Society
Historical
Tonight.
Tonight. Yeah. Historical Tonight.
We are.
It sounds like it's like we're doing like a nightclub act or
tonight
something.
Tonight Show.
Now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's Alana.
And here's Mac.
So, it feels weird just to have the two of us in here.
It is.
It so, like feels empty.
Yes. So you have a very special guest here, me.
That's right. Well, the best.
And then I have you.
I'm sorry.
We'll do it.
But you know, next week is going to be exciting. So we should give actually a preview right now.
Yes. We're going to talk to my father-in-law, Norm Quila.
Now, before people are like nepotism and wow, he's just a guest because you're related.
He's just going to talk about what an amazing daughter-in-law I am.
That's right.
30 minutes, folks.
Well, I might talk about the grandchildren as well.
Yeah, maybe. We're going to talk about the history of fishing. His background in fishing is truly for just him. Starts in middle school.
He's a lifelong fisherman here on the Columbia River and in all parts of like the coast.
Yes. He's Finnish, so his grandparents immigrated here from Finland. They came here, and then he found this love of fishing, and we talked to him about how he got started, and then the family business, too. So he was a fisherman for a long time, went to college, grad school for a long time, but then decided he wanted to do even more than just fish.
We might talk canning.
Yeah, might talk fish processing.
So actually, we should have saved this till the end, because now people are going to be like, oh, this is all they're talking about tonight.
Yeah,
I want to hear this interview, not
I know
Mac and Alana. So yeah, we should skip right to the big history highlights.
Here we go.
So these are things that happen tomorrow. Unless you got anything to plug.
No.
Okay. So these are things that happen tomorrow, August 16th, 1501. Michelangelo is awarded the contract to create his statue of David by the overseers of the Office of Works of the Duma Florence's Cathedral Church. And of course, that ties in. Do you think he ever knew that a statue of his statue would be in the Goonies?
No.
And that they would break a certain part and then glue it on upside down, and the kids would talk about this, and this would become an iconic thing?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure that was going through his mind.
I feel badly for Michelangelo. All right, 1896, gold discovered in the Yukon.
Ooh.
There's gold in them Alaskan river hills.
That's exciting.
And we might talk about more about that. 1898, Edwin Prescott patents the roller coaster.
Fun.
Not quite a zip line, but it kind of ties into last week.
Yes, which you can still catch online.
That's right.
Podcasts.
1918, U.S. troops overrun at Archangelsk by the Bolshevik troops. And see, this is a little tidbit to history that not a lot of people pay attention or remember. But when the Tsar Nicholas II was overthrown by the Bolsheviks, we actually sent troops to Russia.
Oh.
We had troops in Russia. So, and I'm not making a judgment that the United States is evil because of that, but it does kind of give a little bit of the background and why there was years of mistrust in the Cold War is that we tried to stop and make sure the Tsar stayed in power. Ugh. And our troops were actually there in Russia on their soil.
Hmm.
So 1948, Babe Ruth dies.
Aww.
Also ties into the Goonies, Baby Ruth part. No, that doesn't actually, there's no connection between the baseball player.
There
isn't. 1954, Sports Illustrated magazine begins publishing.
Oh, fun.
1977, Elvis Presley dies.
Yes.
Elvis has left the building. But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history on this day, and I'm open to debate on this, 1777, American militiamen defeat British forces at the Battle of Bennington in Vermont during the American Revolutionary War. And most people probably haven't heard of this battle, and it's not just because I was in Vermont for a while that I am not only familiar, but I'm a big fan of this. this was kind of a holding. The Green Mountain Boys, the Vermont troops, were asked to hold so that other American troops could get away.
Hmm.
And had they not won this Battle of Bennington, had they shirked their duties or been overrun, perhaps more troops would have been captured or slaughtered, and perhaps we would not have won the American Revolution.
Ooh.
Or yeah. Actually, we might not. We didn't have right. a lot of wins. We just didn't lose.
Correct.
But we perhaps could have lost really badly.
Right.
So the Battle of Bennington, and there's a great museum there. If you're ever in Vermont, in Bennington, Vermont, is worth it.
Did you work there?
No, I just visited there.
Okay. Well,
because, you know, Ethan Allen was a Green Mountain Boy. Even though he wasn't at this battle, he had already been captured by this point. But I have a fondness for
interesting. Yeah, no, that's
anything
a good one.
Green Mountain Boy related.
Yeah, turn the tide. A couple, certainly not a, you know, highlight, but 1858, U.S. President James Buchanan and Britain's Queen Victoria exchanged messages inaugurating the first transatlantic telegraph line.
Oh, Buchanan.
And I like these. I didn't look up to see what the message was.
Uh-huh.
But and then 1988, IBM introduces artificial intelligence software.
Ooh.
Certainly changing technology. And then 1958, Madonna was born.
Madonna?
Yeah.
Oh, who doesn't love Madonna?
I love her. I cherish her. Cherish
yeah,
the moment.
Ooh, that's one of the best songs.
It is, yeah.
There are many to choose from.
There's so many.
So this is how old I am. I have a CD of the Immaculate Collection that is frequently in my car.
Oh, that's so good. But you said CD, so it's not yes, that old.
Well, but it still
collection.
Shows that I'm old.
It's not on
I
your mean, phone.
I could be having a portable record in my record player in my car if I really wanted to be old. But. So anyway, speaking of, we mentioned the gold discovered in the Yukon, yeah. 1896. And the newspapers of this time period in Clatsop County, there are a lot of people from Clatsop County that went to the gold rush, including a guy named Hope Belt Ferguson. And we actually have his diaries.
Oh, I love it.
In our collection, in our research, in the Lisa Penner Research Center and Archives at the Heritage Museum.
Great.
Not a library, so you can't just come in and read them. But we've written a couple of articles in our Cumtux magazine. And one of these that we're going to use part of is 1998, volume 18, number 4, Fall. And it's by a relative of Hope Belt Ferguson, H. Joseph Ferguson.
Okay.
But there's a lot of great diary references. So we thought we'd kind of talk about Hope Belt Ferguson's incredible journey. At first glance, it might seem unusual for someone 47 years old to leave his family and head for the Alaska Gold Rush. But that's exactly what Astoria's Hope Belt Ferguson did. His family had lived in Astoria off and on since 1849 when his father came west in the California Gold Rush. So gold fever is kind of runs in the family, I think. Hope was actually born elsewhere, and he was 23 years old when his family moved back to Astoria. He had a variety of jobs, including county auditor in Washington and as an investor in a mining company in Idaho.
By the early spring of 1899, Hope Ferguson was planning a trip to Alaska to find gold. The trip began around May 1899 when Hope, his son Roy, and his nephew Tom Bryce took a ship to Skagway, Alaska, intending to go over the Chilcoot Pass to the Yukon in Canada. Clatsop County Deputy Sheriff Grant Trollinger received a letter from Astorian Harry Phillips that the three had spent the previous night, quote, on the summit and left this morning pulling a hand sled with 400 pounds. I advised them to buy a horse, but Hope seemed to think they could manage all right. They may possibly get through before it breaks up, but I doubt it, as the trail is getting bad and the weather is miserable. It has been blowing and snowing for a week steady. Hope and the boys spent some time exploring around Skagway, Atlin, and Dyea. Tom Bryce had left the party to work in Skagway. Hope and his son still headed for the Yukon. At some point, his son left his father for his own adventures. In January 1900, after reaching Dawson City, Hope headed north with Samuel Freeman, another Astorian intending to work their way down the Yukon River to Cape Nome. By March, he was halfway between the two locations. In a letter to his wife, Hope said that he was in good condition, his health never better. He told her that he could run from 35 to 45 miles per day and easily make 30 miles in 6 hours. He added that
he could be doing the Columbia Crossing.
Yeah, that's amazing. He added that it was necessary to make over 3 miles an hour or some part of the body would freeze as the cold averages 45 degrees below. The traveling, he said, is done at the dog trot that is very tiresome at first, but you soon get used to it.
From this point forward, Hope kept a diary that is now part of our collection. So we'll kind of do these in sections, December 15th through December 25th, 1900. Those first few days were filled with enthusiasm, with diary entries short and to the point. Despite being on foot, the party was making good headway. This, in spite of a heavy portage and the Alaska weather. Other gold seekers were also on the trail, and there was some semblance of civilization. On the 21st, the men stayed in a roadhouse, quote, run by parties stranded from the sloop St. George. It's likely that the shelter was constructed from the wreckage of the sloop or was simply the beached St. George intact. I want to know more about this.
How interesting.
You know, is it really like they just used all the lumber from this boat and made a shelter? Or is the boat like
the
right
shelter
there and they're all just staying in it? It was on the 22nd that Hope may have had an inkling of what was to come. Quote, after dark, camped on ice-bearing rim, no wood, fire, or grub, rolled up in a blanket and lay until morning. I fell into the sea through a crevice and got right foot wet. Came near freezing it.
On Christmas Eve of 1900, Hope had crossed Norton Sound, stopping at E.E. Wilkie's Cape Dandy Roadhouse. The dogs were, quote, overly tired. The travelers had covered 175 miles in 10 days. They had to be exhausted, and seeds of doubt were probably not far from their minds. Christmas Day found Hope laying off today, grouse for dinner. It is quite cold, 18 below in wind. Most of the party left for Shaktuluk. I am quite sore from pushing sled.
We should have done like where I do the voices.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure how much of each stuff we had. So, and I should apologize for anybody that is from Alaska and yes, knows how to pronounce these names. I'm sure that we may be mispronouncing some of them. So the next section is December 26th, 1900 to January 1st, 1901. If Hope was bothered by his foot being in the icy water earlier, imagine how he felt on the 26th. He fell in the Unaklik River and had to return to the previous night's camp to change clothes. It turned out not to cause a delay because the weather was so stormy that no travel was possible until December 29th. They reached Unalakik on December 31st. New Year's Day 1901 found Hope's spirits high. Quote, new year, what will it bring us? The natives fired off guns and made quite a hurrah last night. I washed up all my clothes this morning and made hot biscuits. Cooked Dolly Vardeen trout and wild grouse for dinner. The boys seem to enjoy it. There are two stores, a mission school, and about 200 Indians here. Party consists of H.D. Campbell, Dick Walden, Billy Stanton, Boardman, and Joseph. Okay, so fish, you're kind of a fish person. What is Dolly Vardeen trout?
Well, I think it's Dolly Varden.
Varden, okay.
But other than that, I have no idea.
He seems very specific with
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Dolly Varden. But I've heard of people referring to Dolly Vardens.
Okay.
So
apparently
that's all I know.
I'm not a trout enough yeah, trout enough person to know.
January 2nd to January 31st, 1901 entries. It was 19 degrees below zero on January 2nd, but Hope does not editorialize on that fact. The next 5 days were spent traveling from one established camp to another in search of gold. Then, on January 8, signs of increased danger surfaced. The Dozier party of Nome met Ferguson's group as the Doziers retreated. Hope quotes the men and then adds his own comments, quote, there was no trail or grub on Yukon or Kuskokwim rivers, but we go on just the same, end quote. Hope was confident of his own ability as a hunter. He expected to find food where others could not, and trails where none had previously been found. This confidence would cost him dearly.
So it's kind of funny because there's a little bit of, in the diary, a little bit more that we didn't put here, that there's speculation, like, are these people just telling us there's no gold, there's no food, there's no trail, so we won't go there?
Right.
Because they're protecting their little gold interest, or is it legitimate? So there's always this doubt of whether you could believe other people or not.
And why this time of year? This seems like a terrible time of year.
Yeah, no kidding.
To be looking for gold. On the 10th, Hope comments that it must be 40 below zero. And on the 11th, he says it is 60 below. The diary reads, inside tent, covered with heavy frost and hot fire going. One Indian passed for Caltag and Boardman started for Caltag. Crazy. If it does not moderate, we'll stay in camp tomorrow. On January 18th, Hope comments on Boardman once again leaving for Caltag. He had been correct about Boardman's first attempt, but here was the individual trying again in conditions still deteriorating. The next day, the coal oil froze, which reportedly happened only when the temperature declined to 70 below. By the 18th, the weather was not as cold, but, quote, storming on the mountain with headwind. Worse still to hope was the following. Nicholas's party came in from Kuskokwim, claim it's a fake. No gold being found. The next morning, he left for Kaltag. Over the next several days, he would freeze his nose and chin, frostbite, get sick with biliousness, food poisoning, and take poison by mistake.
See, this is why I love the idea of Alaska, but then when I read things like this, I'm not so much.
Yeah.
So February 1st through April 1st, 1901. By February 2nd, Hope was in a decent cabin, presumably near Kaltag. By the beginning of the second week of the month, the men had found fish and other food. They also had established enough contact with the local Native Americans, local Indians, that life had some sense of normalcy. For pay, the Indian woman would patch clothing. On the 9th, Hope wrote, "Very cold and windy. Sullivan, back from Kaltag, says everyone is going back, that there is no gold. Stanton went to village, saw two men from Kuskokwim, who report there is no strike, fish, or anything else on the rim." By the 12th, 9 of the 12 men in his party had given up. Hope writes, "We three go on." On the 14th, he writes, "Knocked dude in the head last night. One dog less."
Oh my gosh.
So you have to realize dude isn't like another guy. It's one of his dogs.
Oh, okay.
"We'll make hard pulling for Kuskokwim now." He still had a sense of humor about him, though, writing, "Mel and Billy are disconsolate, heartbroken, because the young Indian woman had followed the whiskey men down the river." So perhaps there was more than just sewing of clothes going
yes.
on.
On February 23rd, Hope was cooking in camp and the boys were out hunting. They successfully found the trail desired and a cache of abandoned food. Hope says, "We will confiscate." The party was killing grouse and generally finding the food they needed. Perhaps the stories of no gold were also false. March 5th, he writes, "Pleasant good days, traveling across the river twice. Hard work crossing." By the middle of March, the three men were finding grouse, caribou, and Native Americans. Thus, they had food, directions, and even company. 6 days later, though, the situation was reversed. The game had moved on. The party was hungry and needing food. Something must be done soon. Boys did return last night. It is pretty lonely, enough to give one the jitters alone in these mountains. For the next 6 days, the men divided their time between hunting for food and hunting for signs of gold. Hope writes, "I went to look for the cache, traveled from 6:30 a.m. to 10 p.m. without stopping, but found nothing. Snowshoeing 15 and a half hours without rest is hard work. I am very tired tonight."
You know, doing anything for 15 and a half hours without a break, let alone snowshoeing through horrible weather. I kind of like, though, that he just finds a cache and they take it.
Yeah.
I mean, what about the people that put it there?
No.
I feel a little badly for those guys. Okay, so April 1st to June 30th, 1901. April began with a snowstorm and a continued lack of food. The human beings could tough it out for extended periods, but the animals could not. In that regard, and now I'm quoting again, "Killed sport and cooking and feeding him the other dogs. Sindo relishes him, but Fanny won't go near him." Why do I get the killing of the dogs?
I know. Thankfully. That's awful.
And I'm kind of curious that one is like ravenous and eats it, and the other one's like, "Nope, this was my friend not eating it."
Sounds like
His April 4th entry, after visiting a nearby Native American village, "Traded coat for caribou meat and dried fish. Camped at 6:30, estimated travel 18 miles. I am sick, did not eat any supper." The next day he writes, "Ate three small pieces of meat for breakfast. Lived on hot water for balance of day. Dried dog salmon don't agree with me."
Ugh. Things get worse on April 6th. Quote, "No sleep last night, and I have not ate a thing today. Fainted on the trail about an hour after starting out this morning and camped in an old vacant Native American house, which fortunately is in good condition and a stove in it. Hope for a good night's rest. Very tired." The next day he traveled 25 miles to New Kaltag and had, quote, "a good feed of bread and fruit first for 5 days. The rest of April and May seem a combination of hard traveling, being hungry off and on, being cold a lot, falling in frigid water, someone in the party was left behind due to a bad toothache, a raft falling apart on them, fighting mosquitoes, snow."
It just kind of goes on and on.
Yeah.
On May 31st, as though it was nothing special, Hope wrote, warm, slept all day, done some panning in the evening on bar. Good results. So he's gold panning. He's actually finding something. One day later, however, quote, "This is our last day in a camp where we have had to rustle for grub and have really accomplished nothing. We have found plenty of indications of gold, but frost and then high water have kept us from getting to bedrock, but we will get back if possible."
Things were definitely getting bad. On June 1st, he writes, "W have left in grub line. Beside the two grouse just killed, enough sourdough batter for 6 pancakes and 2 cups of old musty flour and nothing else. We don't know when we will get to village and whether they have anything to eat." Things would get worse the next day. June 2nd started out well enough. It was a pleasant day, and in spite of a meager breakfast of rationed flapjacks, the group set off by noon by raft toward the village. Quote, "Floated along nicely until 3 o'clock when we ran into a sweeper which completely capsized us, turning our raft bottom side up. The water was quite deep and icy cold. Billy made for the shore, and Mel and I clung to the raft. I was first onto bottom of raft and ran to the other end to Mel's assistance, as he had gone under raft and had his foot caught, but got out okay. Billy and the two dogs made to the right bank. We had not gone downriver from here more than 200 yards when we were hung up by a snag by the tent, which was lashed on overload, having come loose and dragging. After some time, we cut it loose and we landed a few hundred feet below on a bar, where after an hour or two of work and being in the cold water up to our waists, we succeeded in turning the raft. In addition to all of their food supplies, the group also lost their shotgun, making hunting nearly impossible."
The professional broadcaster in you hates like having to read somebody's diary, doesn't it?
Because the grammar's a little off.
It's 1901. He's freezing in Alaska, and he's keeping a diary. So the grammar isn't always the best or in the right order. The next morning, they found a piece of bacon rind, 2 inches by 6 inches, and cut it into 3 pieces.
Someone else's food again.
There's a good breakfast for you. Drifting downriver, they landed at a Native American village and ate well. A few days later, Hope ate some tainted meat and got seriously ill. And he goes into great detail describing the meat. It's really pretty gross. He recovered, and they continued their journey downriver. On June 28th, he writes, "3 nights and 2 days traveling without sleep and hardly anything to eat. We are all very weak and worn out. All have lost from 15 to 20 pounds flesh on this trip. I am as thin as a wafer, but our troubles are now probably over."
Ever hopeful. It is getting warmer, right? July 1st to August 6, 1901. Hope and his friends arrived at Grayling, a settlement large enough to be a stop for the Sternwheelers. The group split up at this point. On July 3rd, Hope turned 48. He was with some new friends and in a small boat heading downriver. He didn't have much to celebrate, writing, quote, "My arm sprained, swollen, and paining continually. A bad cut finger and an ulcerated tooth, jaw swollen twice in size, and a headache," end quote. He eventually made his way to Nome. His last entry in his diary is on August 6, 1901. He writes that he is feeling much better, rested, and ready for another trip. In the winter of 1902, Hope struck it rich. The local newspaper here reports he had a claim on a tributary of the Yukon about 500 miles from its mouth. Large nuggets were reported being taken from the bed off the stream, and the quartz ledge on the claim was said to be very rich. Hope Belt Ferguson did not live long after returning from Alaska, though. He died on May 17th, 1904, less than 3 years after the end of his Alaska adventure.
Isn't that kind of incredible?
Yeah.
I kind of wish we knew how much he made.
Yeah.
Like when he did kind of strike it rich. And, you know, you said something about the eternal optimist, and that's what keeps coming through in these diaries. All the entries is that he's always like really upbeat. And
now today is going to be the day.
Yeah. And there's a little bit, you know, the author of this, who's a relative, talks about it's so strange that he's 47 and he's going out on this adventure when it's kind of a young man's game. But part of it is this confidence and optimism. And he also thinks, well, I'm a great woodsman.
And obviously he was.
And I'm a great fisherman, so I don't need all these supplies. I'll be able to forage off the land. But since we have a little bit of time, I grabbed the bigger article here just because it is really gross, and I like the gross stuff, as you know. On June 10th, Hope made a very bad error for an experienced woodsman. He knowingly ate tainted food. And this is a quoting now in his diary. "The caribou was killed last January." It's June 10th. "Last January, and is full of old, dried, clotting blood and green with mold, but tastes good to hungry and starved men." Though Hope tried to talk little of it, he was seriously ill from the rotted meat. A full week later, he writes, This diet is not agreeing with me. Fainted twice yesterday and once today.
Awful.
Mold and green. Why are you 6 months later in no fridge or freezer? Why are you eating this?
Yeah. Well, why did they still have it?
Yeah. Where was it?
Yeah.
I don't know if he just found it or what, but that kind of grosses me out. And I love the line. This diet's not agreeing with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not agreeing for a reason.
Not so much. Yeah.
So next week we have a special guest.
We do.
And we did make a big deal about it at the beginning, but yeah. I'd like to make an even bigger deal about it. Not just because it's a relative, but...
Yeah.
And how old is your father-in-law?
He just turned 90.
90?
Yes, last month. But and we had a celebration in our backyard with grandchildren, and yeah, it was fun.
And he's sharp.
He is.
He's sharp as can be.
Papa Norm is what the kids call him.
Papa Norm? Is that what the grandkids...
Papa Normie. Mm-hmm.
The grandkids call him?
Yes.
Have fun.
Yeah, so it's good. And yeah, and he's going to talk about the cannery and processing and why he got into fishing, because this isn't something that his father did, because often this is something that is passed down and he passed down to his children.
So what I want to know, because Mark and his brother are both in the same, were both in the same business.
Mm-hmm.
Was it forced upon them, or was it just they love what dad did and they tagged along and started doing what he did?
Well, I think they have their own reasons. They too went to college. They both went to Oregon State as well after high school and got degrees. And then Paul came back and he wanted to fish. Mark tried it and he gets a little seasick. So that was it for him. So he took over the processing plant and cannery. This is where he'd worked all his life anyways. Mm-hmm. So it was very natural to him. And he continued at that age to just work alongside his dad, which is something that he enjoyed and continued to do for a long time until he took over the business.
You be the fisherman, I'll be the landlubber.
Yeah. Yeah. So very different and very different skill sets too, right? I mean, it's hard to be a fisherman. It's hard to do either one.
So not work. That I ever want to give our guests homework, but anytime I chat with somebody who is in the fishing industry at all, keep in mind, I'm going to ask what his favorite fish is.
Oh, okay.
So you might warn him of that.
All right. I will.
Because I always do.
You know, one interesting thing. So I've known Mark's family since I was a young, young child. Mm-hmm. And I do remember going to their house when I was a little kid and eating sturgeon caviar. And it wasn't until later in life that I learned what a delicacy that was. I just thought it was just something that looked weird and tasted kind of different. I ate it and it was fine, but I didn't think it was special by any means.
So I was going to ask, as a little kid, was it gross to you? Was it slimy?
It was fine.
Or was you like, oh yeah, this is yummy?
It's okay. But later, you know, later when you're like, oh my gosh, and they had like jars of it. It's just an afternoon snack. Here you go. Here's some caviar to, you know.
And here I'm eating peanut butter sandwiches.
Exactly.
All right. Well, this has been this is a lot of fun, and it's kind of amazing how many historians and Warrentonians and other people went to Alaska. And the newspapers of this time period always have like these updates of, we got a letter from this person, we got a letter from that person, and
continue to today, right?
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So, all right. Well, thanks for listening. Go make some history, and we will catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.